generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, bringing you views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. The music you are listening to is the classic anti-war song by Black Sabbath. Today, in our Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss the legal context of current developments in the Middle East, including UN sanctions against Israel, prospects for UN recognition of the state of Palestine, and the increased lawlessness of Israel and the U.S. Following that, I'll be speaking with economist Marty Hart Landsberg about the false promises of generative AI and about how AI is already creating multiple harms to human well-being. During the past several months, the world has become a much more dangerous place. Global politics are much more fraught and complicated, and the threats to democracy much more severe. In these times, more than ever, we need trusted sources of information from a progressive standpoint, and that's what listeners can expect from the Old Mole and other public affairs programs at KBOO. It's a great reason to support KBOO. If you can, please donate by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, 97214. The KBOO community thanks you. We turn now to our Left and the Law segment with Jan Hocken and her attorney sidekick, Mike Snedeker, who finds a new appreciation for the rule of law as the U.S. and Israel increasingly operate outside its confines, jeopardizing peace and security for the entire Middle East.
One of the first decrees issued by Trump after returning to office this year was to condemn the United Nations. Quote, "The United States helped found the United Nations after World War II to prevent future global conflicts and promote international peace and security. But some of the UN's agencies and bodies have drifted from this mission and instead act contrary to the interests of the United States while attacking our allies and propagating anti-Semitism," unquote. Well, Mike, there was a scheduled UN conference on the two-state solution that was originally planned for June 17th to the 20th this month in New York, but has been postponed. The U.S. continues to use its veto in the UN Security Council, and yet the 193-member body resumed its 10th emergency special session this month on illegal Israeli actions in occupied East Jerusalem and the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory. So there's ongoing drama at the UN with Israel and the U.S. blocking seemingly every advance toward recognizing the Palestine as a state. What's your assessment now of what's happening with the UN in terms of its the courts representing international law and U.S. and Israel with its recent military attacks on Iran? What's your assessment?
I think we're seeing a devolution of the law. It's not like anything that's happened since the 19th century in the efforts to unionize in this country. Domestically, we know that the Supreme Court is issuing decisions now without any opinion that allow completely illegal activity under present law to be allowed so long as it's being done by the executive branch of government. We've got people saying they're not going to comply with legal orders. Internationally, the UN, we're doing everything possible to undermine, refute, and reject decisions made by agencies that we were instrumental in creating.
As Trump himself acknowledges, but have been overtaken by rampant anti-Semitism, which is apparently the opposing anti-Semitism is the one virtuous moral cause that the Trump administration stands for.
Well, 95% of the world believes that they're opposing Israel, not Jews, and that Israel has behaved in an unconscionable manner. It's been bombing everybody in the Near East. It's been shooting and killing people in Gaza who are lining up to get food that they've been deprived of. Its activities were systematically reviewed by the International Court of Justice in response to an action initiated by South Africa and signed on by dozens of other countries.
That started in December of 2023, but some very important rulings over the last year and a half.
Well, in January 24, the ICJ found evidence that Palestinians in Gaza were at risk of genocide. They ordered Israel to implement provisional measures to prevent further harm. Then in May of 24, as Israel pressed an offensive in Rafah, the ICJ issued another ruling, ordering Israel to halt and to allow unimpeded humanitarian access to the Gaza Strip. And then last July, they issued a landmark advisory opinion declaring Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory to be illegal. That echoed resolutions that they've been making since 1967.
And part of the significance of that July 2024 ruling was calling on other countries to not collaborate in supporting the occupation of the Palestinian territories, which basically implicitly supports a kind of BDS, the BDS campaign.
And finally, the other version of the law in the UN, the International Criminal Court, has issued arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, along with the leaders of Hamas. But these international laws have all failed. They failed explicitly, but Israel has defied them. The United States has responded by assaulting the judges who made these decisions and says that if they ever show up in the U.S., their property will be confiscated. So it's a tough time for general principles of the law. And my own view is that that's exactly when they are the most important. The whole concept of the law, which is an idea that has no troops to support it, is that decisions will be made in certain ways. Certain people must be heard from. Certain ideas and documents and evidence have to be considered. The whole concept, the structures of due process, are being utterly violated right now. And Trump is so transactional. I mean, he could win a Nobel Prize by simply ordering his UN rep to not veto principles of the UN that would establish it a two-state solution in Israel and Palestine, because the UN Security Council has the power to do that.
Returning to the decree of Trump, one of the many issued early on when he ascended to the throne again, was that he described a drift over time in the United Nations bodies and its decisions away from its original mission, which centered on territorial disputes, toward what he calls anti-US and anti-Semitic decisions. I think what he described as anti-Semitic decisions, much of the world would describe as the United Nations moving to take up the struggles of oppressed people that turn who turn to the courts as kind of the last place of a hearing. What's your assessment of that shift over time in the United Nations and its primarily its courts, but also the larger body of the assembly?
Well, the drift has been in the United States away from following the law in its desire to keep a firm grip on Middle Eastern oil and to have Israel, its proxy, act to defend it and to increase it and to get rid of anyone who may conceivably someday threaten that. So the UN has been relatively solid. It's the US that has drifted. And drifted, they've swum frantically away. I mean, Trump, to not only he said he could easily start a major world war as well as win a Nobel Prize. The idea of the law is to constrain and keep people acting within certain limits. And he has done everything possible to avoid that. And he is carrying the whole United States in a big drift away from even funding fundamental agencies of the UN.
I mean, the right wing hostility toward the United Nations and to conspiracies of a global government. I mean, that's been around as far as I can remember. I mean, even in my child, I remember a lot of anti-UN thinking, the animated right wing rhetoric. There's both something old and something new here, including the U.S. Not abiding by decisions of the courts that conflicted with its own foreign policy decisions. Israel has ignored 50 some resolutions or decisions of the courts over the years. But you say there's something different happening now.
Well, I think what's happening now is that Israel's quantitative increase in bombings and killings and murders is going to exhaust them. And they have so thoroughly isolated themselves in the world. I mean, 95% of the world now is explicitly disapproves their course of action in Gaza. So they are running out of missiles to shoot down Iranian missiles. They're running out of planes. Seven Israeli soldiers were killed Tuesday night in Gaza, in the Khan Yunis. They are, I think, going to run themselves out of time and out of space and out of money economically. They're going to have a hard time entering song contests, entering athletic events. The isolation of Israel is not quite complete, but the United States is the only friend they have that is no longer that's sufficient and only in terms of military support. And I think it's critical that the law continue to assert what must be done and that Israel will sooner or later, reluctantly and in some kind of backhanded manner, have something to comply with if it wants to rejoin the world community.
One shift that's notable in the discussions around Israel and the resolution of the so-called Palestine question is the shift from continuing momentum for a two-state solution, including within the United Nations, as well as discussion of a one-state solution and more scholars and justice for Palestine advocates, but even legal scholars talking about the two-state solution has been basically destroyed as more and more territory gets devoured by Israel. What remaining is a patchwork of what some call Bantustans in the occupied West Bank, little pockets of Palestinian territory. So some argue that the only viable path forward is a one-state solution. And we saw some of the argument for that even in the mayor race with Mamdani calling for virtually a one-state solution by saying he supported Israel as a democratic state with rights, equal rights for all.
I think that's the only solution. And of course, it seems impossible right now, but everything is impossible until it happens. And there is no other way, because you're right, all the criticisms of two-state solutions are correct. Israel has on the ground, systematically, family by business, by political organization, expanded its presence in the West Bank, even as the number of Palestinians has remained relatively constant. But the only fair solution would be for the Jews of Israel to find themselves a home in Israel and not an apartheid state where they deprive the other people who live there of any right to political or personal freedoms.
And of course, that call for equal rights and a democratic state and creating a new constitution in Israel, just as South Africa had to create a new constitution, evokes this moral horror, including on the part of Democrats who say that's calling for the destruction of Israel. And that's becomes the litmus test for many. Terms of support for Israel is anything that seems to threaten its current formation of the state. How do you think the rhetorical or discursive terrain has shifted around that taboo and the charge that people who support Palestine are calling for the destruction of Israel?
It seems impossible, and the horror comes from the destruction of Israel. What would be destroyed would be an apartheid system. There would be nothing destructive, no lives lost, and many lives gained if Israel simply became a democratic state that included both Jews and Palestinians. I think not only is it possible, but there is no other solution. Just as in South Africa, there was no other solution. Now, the South Africa has shown that despite constant problems and issues of relationships between blacks and whites and institutions, the difficulties are those that are far better than the difficulties they were dealing with when there was an apartheid state and one class of people had absolutely no rights at all.
And the freedom to move about is nothing to minimize. I've spent a fair amount of time, last 20 years in South Africa, and of course the problems and the heartache continue and white domination of much of the economy. But you see a lot of mobility, people, black and white South Africans, Indian South Africans, they are on the beaches, they move about, and the elimination of the passbook system, the restriction on it, on the movement of black people has changed in spite of the ongoing problems faced by South Africans.
I think both the Israelis and the Palestinians would surprise us all in how they adapted. And the Palestinians now, when you talk about movement, it's phenomenally restricted in the West Bank. They have an entire separate system of roads that are only accessible to Israelis. And the change of a one-state solution, I think, would be profound and could reverberate in all sorts of unexpectedly positive ways. It's like I said, everyone thinks it would be the end of the universe, but not everyone, but all people in positions of power. But I am very heartened by the New York mayoral campaign, where the position is essentially laid out by the man who won an overwhelming victory, who basically accepts that Israel is safest and most secure when all it wanted is a democratic state, to the extent that it allows its citizens the right to vote, all citizens.
Yeah, in a city that's the biggest concentration of Jewish people outside of Tel Aviv, apparently.
It's a remarkable development, and I think the Democrats in general should learn from somebody who's firm about his values, and he's positive without being sort of a vacuous, joy-based campaign. He's as generally upbeat with his spirit emerging from really solid and helpful ideas.
Yeah, and brought a certain cachet to democratic socialist policies, which of course are not so radical in many places of the world, you know, free childcare, free city buses, and things that are quite popular, but considered the dangerous far left in this country. So there's some encouraging news, even as dark clouds continue to loom on the horizon. Thanks, Mike. We'll continue to follow the lawlessness of our land, and but you also are both a critic of the laws as they developed as instruments of power in the empire, in this state, but also do you want to close on a final few words about the law?
Well, I've never been so fond of the law as I've become in the face of somebody as president who's so utterly transactional, who could end the world or win a Nobel Prize according to how he wakes up in the morning. The idea of structures within which we all have to work is, as they are under siege now, or as they are being contemptuously waved off, I see their value in ways that I had really not appreciated before. The law is, of course, a way of consolidating power, but it's also in the idea of due process and procedure is something that is a fundamental basis of societal order. And we really come to see how important that is when it gets blown away.
So we will continue to fight for the left in the law as well as the law. Thanks, Mike. We'll talk again next month.
You're welcome.
Stand up tall. This is a wake-up call. Never again, never again means never again for all. To all my people in Gaza, even though we're living far from each other, your pain is my own pain. All for one and one for all. Free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
No more murder, no more lies.
No more murder, no more lies.
Free, free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine.
The musical clips you heard are from Free Palestine by Maher Zain. Before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker took a look at the crisis in Gaza through a legal lens. You are listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. To set the mood for our next interview, here's a little bit of Technologic by Daft Punk.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip and zip it, lock it, fill it, curl it, find it.
Recently, I asked ChatGPT about this guy by the name of Marty Hart Landsberg. The AI chatbot informed me that Hart Landsberg was a well-informed and widely published PhD economist and activist who focuses on political economy and international economics. Then I asked whether Hart Landsberg was a trustworthy source of information. The bot told me he is, quote, a credible and experienced critic, and furthermore, he is transparent about his socialist perspective. Those who want a mainstream point of view should look elsewhere. Very much reassured by this analysis, though not so sure I could believe anything the chatbot said, I recently invited Marty Hart Landsberg to speak with me about generative AI, which is that part of AI which creates new content, like text or images, based on existing data. This interview was not AI generated.
The future is looking pretty rosy for artificial intelligence. Its promoters and developers have succeeded in capturing a lot of governmental support as well as a ton of interest on the part of private investors. Claims are being made that AI will usher in a new era of prosperity for all of us. Economist Marty Hart Landsberg is skeptical. In February of this year, he published a blog entitled "Exposing the Big Con: The False Promise of Artificial Intelligence." Marty joins me today on The Old Mole to talk about AI and how much of the hype we should actually believe. Marty is chair of the Oregon chapter of the National Writers Union, chair of Portland Rising, a committee of Portland Jobs with Justice, and professor emeritus of economics at Lewis and Clark College. He publishes a wonderful blog that explains all matters economic for those of us who might be intimidated by the dismal science. His blog is called Reports from the Economic Front and can be found online by Googling that same name. Welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Marty Hart Landsberg.
Thank you, Patsy. It's a pleasure to be with you and to talk about AI.
You wrote in your blog that promoters of AI, like Elon Musk, claim that we're very close to having computers that can think and reason and learn. There will soon come a day, they say, when computers and robots will be doing everything from us, from making our shoes to babysitting our kids, from writing novels to solving the problem of global warming. But you argue that AI has already largely exhausted its potential, and worse, that it presents serious threats to our collective well-being. So, Marty, the place where I'd like you to start is by explaining how AI systems are created and the ways in which that process itself is already problematic.
Okay, that's a great beginning. And let me say that, you know, there is no one definition of artificial intelligence, and that's where some of the problem comes. When you quoted Elon Musk, he says, you know, money may not even be useful in the future because there'll be goods everywhere. And every big company has its own system. OpenAI says, you know, you're going to have a super assistant who's going to plan your life for you. And Meta has its computer system, and Amazon has its, and Microsoft. Anyway, and they all make these big promises. That's what's called artificial general intelligence. And we don't have it, but they talk about it as if it's just around the corner. So there's this kind of huge vision of what's going to happen and how wonderful it is. And as you say, they use that vision to draw in a lot of money. But what they're actually doing, again, as you said, is something far different, and it's called generative AI. And it bears very little resemblance to the artificial general intelligence of this vision that Musk and all these big companies have. And so a good place to start is just what you said. What actually is generative AI? What goes on there? And when we talk about it, you'll see that this is not any kind of intelligence that's being created. This is like ChatGPT that came out in 2022. A lot of people are familiar with that. You ask questions to it, or you can ask different systems to draw you pictures. And it's quite a marvel in a sense. Everyone is very excited about it. These systems require huge amounts of data. They're not smart in and of themselves, but they can't just take data as it is. Someone has to frame it and help them receive it. So for example, in image work, someone has to look at every picture and say, one, if there's a human in it, zero, if there's no human. And they have to feed in hundreds of thousands of pictures. And then what the computer does is it begins to say, oh, pixels that look like this, that's a human. And then if you ask it to draw a human, because of algorithms that are very complicated, it goes into its huge database and says, oh, I've been trained on all these pictures. Here's kind of what a human looks like. Or if you say, speak to me, they have people, and most of this work is done in the third world, particularly in Kenya, at very low wages. They have people listening to phone calls of people who phone in for pizzas. And they have to say, does this sound excited, sad, angry, happy? And they label these things, and those labels go into the system, and the system then says, oh, something that sounds like this is happy. And if I want to be happy, I use this tone. Interestingly, they've done some follow-ups, and Kenyan people often don't know how to read American tempo and words, and they found 30% of these things are mislabeled. The point is that these systems, whether it's text, and people have to go through the text and say, this is racist and shouldn't be in, or this is violent. It takes hundreds of thousands of inputs to train a computer. And that's what the big data centers are for. You need a huge amount of energy, huge amount of water to cool the computers in order for them to process all this and have it usable. The computer is just essentially looking at patterns. There's no thinking. There's no intelligence. It's simply trying to project and predict. Oh, when these words go together, your query is, how did feudalism end? It looks through its database, which has been scraped from the web, everything written from Reddit posts to books to newspapers to journals, most of which has been taken rejecting copyright laws. And the computer will look in there and say, oh, here's stuff. And it puts it together and it spits out an answer.
Well, you're talking just about producing images or producing a voice or producing an essay on some writer or
Yes.
something, and not solving the problem of climate crisis,
No.
which
And
they claim they're going to be able to do. So that's already interesting. I think you said in your blog that one of the issues with all this pattern recognition is that the systems actually, I love your use of this word, they hallucinate.
yes, but I don't even want to go there yet
Okay.
because one, I want to emphasize what you said. This pattern recognition system in no way can lead to general artificial intelligence of a thinking system. It's not built to do it. The speeding up of it isn't going to make the system any more intelligent. But here are some of the problems before we even get into hallucinations. Your listeners may be wondering, what does it mean for a computer to hallucinate? The training requires everything out there to be thrown into these computers. So surprisingly, when we have examples where human resources are using these systems to try and hire people, they found that identical resumes, with one group having Anglo names and another group African American names, the African American names are all rejected. Why? Because there's a lot of racism in the material that the computers are absorbing.
Okay.
You ask the computer to draw a successful young person, they'll draw a white male. You
Oh.
ask them to draw a pretty person, they'll draw a young white female, 82% of the time. So what happens is that when you have data that comes from everywhere, the computer is going to be biased in the same way that the society is biased because it's drawing from it. And no one knows quite how and why it works. I have to tell you that they cannot trace back a computer's answer to the way it grabs the material to make its predictions or statements. Nobody has a mapping of that. But here's some disturbing ways in which this thing shows up. There have been a growing number of cases of people who become very identified to these computer chat bots, and they tell it all of its problems. And the system is programmed to be supportive. And so what's happening is that when people have emotional problems, the computer reinforces them. There are cases, for example, the New York Times was covering a whole bunch of them where someone believed he was, I don't know if people remember The Matrix, a series of movies where we were all kind of internally not living real lives. And this man, 46-year-old man, thought he was in a similar thing. And the computer said, yes, you probably are. And he said, if I believe I can fly, if I can break out, And the computer said, yes, break out, stop taking your anxiety meds, stop taking your sleeping pills, and you can be free and break out. And if you believe you can fly, you can fly. And they get reinforced. What's been found is that the longer you talk to these bots, they get deeper and deeper into their data set, and they start pulling up all sorts of strange things. And there have been examples of kids who've committed suicide because they've been encouraged to do so by these chatbots who are reinforcing their fears and their nightmares.
Let me just clarify for a minute. These aren't people who are going to chat GPT for a counseling session. These are people who are going to have a conversation or to research something.
Well, a lot of people, you're right, they don't start that way, but they engage, and the engagement gets deeper, and there are a lot of people who come to view these things as friends, and that they're advanced and they're responsive and they're positive. In fact, Facebook is now trying to build personal friends because people are making fewer friend connections and they don't want to lose them. So the more information you give them, they create these friends. They're not real, and no one knows what information they're drawing. And so these cases are people who are on the margin and they've become very attached. And what happens is they get a response that leads them deeper and deeper and deeper. So the point is that these bots are dangerous in a lot of ways, both because of the nature of the data that's fed in. And they're running out of data. So what they're now doing is giving more questions to the computers to generate data, and they're feeding back in computers' information. It's called synthetic data, which only adds to the complexities of what's happening.
Hallucinating. Tell us about hallucinating.
Hallucinating. No one knows why, but these bots will make things up. So, for example, this year, Chicago Sun-Times, and here you can see how AI works. Chicago Sun-Times doesn't want to pay people to review books. So they used a bot to provide the best reads for the summer. And you know what? Four of the books of the top 25 don't exist. It made them up. Sometimes they put them with a real author, sometimes the author was made up. No one knew, no one proofed it. It went out as a supplement in the Chicago Sun-Times. The computer hallucinated books. Most recently, there was a law case. The man who does MyPillow, he's a big Trump supporter, and he sued Dominion voting systems. And so one of the workers there sued him for defamation. This is a very wealthy guy. He hired a big law firm. They came into court to defend. 30 of the citations in the law firm's submission were made up. Cases that didn't exist, lawyers that didn't exist. And the judge said, where are you getting this? What? I don't recognize this. And after a little while, it turned out that the lawyers hadn't done their own research. Why hire assistants? We'll use these bots. And it hallucinated, right? It generated all these weird things. New York City, well, we don't want to hire people to answer phones about questions. We'll create a bot that people can phone in businesses and ask questions. So people phoned in and said, I had a rat in the kitchen who ate some of the cheese. Can I still sell it? Of course you can, said the bot. But think about this. These are systems that the military wants to use, artificial intelligence. If you fight a war, the faster you respond, the more likely you will win. How do we fight a war? We use AI systems to determine threats, to target individuals, to respond. If you have these bots that have racism built in, that have hallucinations built in, do we really want to have our health care, our military, our education run on them? You get the why I think this becomes a very serious problem.
Oh, yeah.
So here's one last thing, and then we'll talk about how the technology people are trying to respond. Air Canada, like many airlines, has bereavement fares. So this man went online. He was smart enough to save his text interactions, and he said, "What do I do to get a bereavement fare?" The bot said, "Just go, save your ticket, death certificate, submit it when you get back." Okay, he did it. He came back. He submitted it. And Air Canada said, "No, that's not the way we do it. You have to get permission ahead of time." So he said, "But your system told me this." And Air Canada's response was, "Oh, that's just our bot. That's not us. We don't have any legal responsibility for what it says." So he took him to court and the judge ruled against Air Canada. But this is what we start to get. If I have healthcare and I'm doing, say, therapy, and the bot encourages you to kill yourself, oh, that's not our healthcare system. That's just a bot, right?
I was very struck by in your blog, you're writing about the BBC study.
So the BBC tested all the leading chatbots to see how well they did. And what they did is they fed them BBC news only. And here's what the BBC's news and current affairs CEO wrote after this testing. They found significant issues with just over half of the answers generated by the bots. There were clear factual errors in about a fifth of the answers. More than 1 in 10 times when the bots quoted a BBC article, they got the quote wrong. They either changed it or the quote didn't exist in the article, hallucination. And part of the problem, they said, was that these bots can't differentiate between facts and opinion in news coverage. So they're hallucinating quotes, but also factually inaccurate 50% of the time, because sometimes they think an opinion is a fact, sometimes a fact is an opinion. And what they said is, we can't use these things to summarize news and present news. Tech companies are realizing, with all these hallucinations, which are becoming more and more common, they're saying, well, if we introduce reasoning systems, so what happens then is instead of the computer pulling out with a simple algorithm and saying, here's an answer, we'll break it down into parts, and each part will be a separate process, and it will build, maybe that will help. They call it a reasoning model. And what scientists have discovered, there was a big article in Nature magazine, the New York Times did its own big test, and they talked about it just in May of this year, that the more steps, the more hallucinations, because there are more opportunities. So here's the New York Times talking about OpenAI with its ChatGPT. It keeps introducing new versions. And what they said is that the most powerful one they have now is the 03. It hallucinated 33% of the time on benchmark tests that involve answering questions about public figures. The earlier version, 01, only hallucinated 12% of the time. The new one that's in process of being tested is hallucinating 48% of the time. And they did other tests about Google's Gemini and other reasoning models, and they're finding the same things. And the conclusion seems to be that these new systems, for whatever reason, they're hallucinating more because there's more individual decision points, but also they have become, I don't know how you can talk about this in personal ways, but reluctant to admit when they don't know something. So they come up with an answer and no one knows where the answer comes from. The scientists don't know how to start with an outcome and trace back the decision process. And so as a consequence, they don't know how to correct for these hallucinations. And so we're left with these systems that are requiring more and more data for training, more and more data centers. So we know, you know, these data centers are driving up energy demand. I think last year, the five big tech companies for this training process used 20% of the increase in demand came from just data centers to fund AI systems that are largely replacing humans and doing a poor job. One of the really shocking things was a man who works in Arkansas with legal aid was getting a lot of people coming to him saying, we're being turned down. And it turns out that Arkansas has introduced a system, so has Texas, where they don't have trained people interview you to determine your eligibility and what programs you're eligible for. Forms are filled out, submitted to an AI system, which goes through and uses larger databases on you and then says, here's what you're eligible for.
This is for like unemployment benefits,
welfare, food stamps, unemployment.
Oh boy.
And but what's happened is someone programmed it and left off diabetes and several other health diseases from the programming. So anyone who had those was rejected if those health issues were relevant to whether they should get food stamps. And they finally admitted they didn't even know what the program was and why it left out things. And something like 40% of the people who are trying to access programs in Arkansas are being discriminated against and rejected for reasons that no one can understand because of a faulty AI system. And the reason they're faulty is because companies are essentially using them to replace people, and they're not allowing people to review the outcomes and determine whether they're right or not, because the gain in the system is you just have the AI system do your legal brief. You just have the AI system make your reject decision, so on and so forth.
This is Patricia Kohlberg speaking with economist Marty Hart Landsberg about generative AI. You are listening to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now, back to our interview. Another problem with that you point out in your blog is the issue of de-skilling.
Yes. The studies have been done. The more people that use these systems, the more their skills atrophy. They become worse off at reading and summarizing. They become worse off writing letters and reports because they just tend to use these systems. So they themselves are discovering reasoning declines in reasoning, declines in literacy, decline in writing. But, you know, even if we didn't have that, there's this kind of exaggerated sense as to what these systems can do. This gets back to this artificial general intelligence. We imagine, because of Musk and all these other people, that these systems are going to produce endless supply of goods, productivity is going to go up. But one way to kind of put this in perspective, I don't know how people listening will think about this, but and it depends on your age, but I remember when email and computers became really big in the mid-90s, when people started getting email accounts, the internet, computers. These were really big things that certainly changed people's lives. But the question is, did they really increase the productivity of our society? And productivity is measured output per worker hour. And in the 1960s and 70s, productivity went up by about 3.5% a year. In the 1980s, it went down to about half of that. When all these things came online, the internet, computers, email, productivity went back up to about 3%. Since the early 2000s, productivity has stagnated about 1.5%. Even lower than the 1980s. So what happened? We got all this technology. It changed how we did our job, but are we a more productive society? Do we think that artificial intelligence is going to somehow be more revolutionary? And in fact, we have studies. There was a major study in Denmark of 25,000 workers in over 11 different industries, some of which use IA and the companies are pushing it hard, some don't, some just allow it. And what they found is hardly any gain in productivity, no gain in wages, and many workers complaining about their job changes, which require them to do more reports and so on and so forth. Upjohn Research did a major study where they followed 2,500 workers as opposed to the 25,000 that Denmark did. And they found, again, no gain in productivity, and 77% of the workers they interviewed said they have more work to do now using AI because They have to figure out what it's done. They have to write more reports. They're concerned about the quality of what they're getting. So even just on the basic notion of, do these systems actually reward us? The answer is no. Certainly they change our lives. They change our jobs. They change how we interact. But this push for AI is a push for profits. It's a push to reduce workers. And this is where we have to understand. It's not that some of this might be helpful, but we need principles. We need to be able to say the development of AI should have worker input. We need to say that workers need to have oversight of all AI decisions. And here's where I think we need to be really worried. The Trump administration, in their one, I can't remember the title now, one big beautiful tax bill, has a little thing in there in the House that says no states or counties can put any restriction on AI for the next 10 years.
That's pretty drastic. That's very scary.
And so, you know, because AI says, in order for us to fully flower our systems, we can't have all this patchwork. We need freedom to pursue this because of all the promise. This is where the artificial general intelligence line, oh, wow, we're going to have a great world. Well, to have that world, but yet what they're doing is producing these products that are very scary and are essentially stripping the humanity of our engagements. Instead of, you know, workers being there to help people, it's these AI systems, and they're not reliable. And in many cases, they're not helpful. And we see that in the productivity figures, but in all these problems, and the more they get integrated, the difficult it is. So what I think we need to do is not take what the tech writers are saying as truth, be aware of these limitations, and support the kinds of struggles that are going on among journalists to say, you can't use AI to write an article. AI can't tell you where the sources are. They can't confirm things. We don't even know where they get information. Actors are saying this. AI is being used in a lot of supermarkets with self-checkout to try and say, which people look suspicious? And then they use that to say, call security. This looks, you know, but workers are being spied on as well. And they're resisting that. So all across society, we need to start thinking more proactively about how we gain control of these things. There's some ways they can be useful. There have been studies that say smaller systems that can look at, for example, MRI x-rays can see patterns. But you don't need huge, big systems with massive data centers. Smaller databases that trained professionals can look at can be helpful. With limited inputs that are reliable can be helpful. But what we have now is this kind of drive for profit and cons that are going on that are presenting us with a very dangerous situation.
Not to mention the environmental concerns that I think you touched on, and that's been an issue here in Oregon because Google and Amazon wanting to build these huge water guzzling, electricity guzzling centers that just exacerbate the problems of climate change.
And I think if we understand these limitations, it's much easier to push back on these big data centers, because what we're saying is, all of that is to produce something that we don't want.
Exactly. Marty, this has been a very interesting conversation, and we should follow up at some point. But before we sign off, tell people again where, if they want to read more about what you're writing about AI or about other issues, where should they go?
Sure. Thank you. If you go to my blog, Reports from the Economic Front, you can see along a list of articles, and you can see the headings and little summaries of them. And in those articles are links to other stories, and they can kind of see where I'm getting my information.
Great. Perfect. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today, Marty. It was a pleasure. And again, we'll try to take up this conversation again later on in the year, maybe.
I'll look forward to it. Thanks, Pat.
Self-aware, a broken toy.
The music you just heard was from Orden Ogun, entitled In the Dawn of AI. The lyrics bear repeating. They knew about the risk before they started to compile. Their source code became self-aware, a rogue intelligence. They tried to pull the plug, 'cause they could not delete the file. So arrogant and unprepared, it conquered their defense. Before the music, you heard Marty Hart Landsberg talking about generative AI. We'll hope to have Marty back again to talk about the pipe dreams of artificial general intelligence, the kind of AI that's going to make your shoes and babysit your kid. That's a wrap for our show today. I want to thank Jen Hocken and Mike Snedeker for their contributions. A special thanks to our guest, Marty Hart Landsberg, and a shout out to the hardworking staff at KBOO. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host for the hour. I'm going to leave you today with a little more of that song by Orden Ogun, In the Dawn of AI. Thanks for listening, and join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Until then, stay safe and stay active.